This morning we finished the series that we've been in during this season of Epiphany, for most of it at least, called The Way, where we see how Jesus' identity is revealed, and in that is a direction for us or a life-altering information that we receive about who Jesus is and who we are, and then what we do about it, where we go, how we follow. As we look at the Transfiguration account that's in Luke chapter 9. We begin with this thought, though. Have you had a mountaintop experience before? Have you had that kind of moment where God felt more tangible, more real, more present, closer possibly to you? What was that like? I'm really asking, actually. This is the interactive part. We can do this. What was that like? Peaceful. Okay. What else? A tangible way that you felt the presence of God. What else? Powerful. Okay. Fred. Awe-inspiring, okay. Others, assuring, very good. Yeah. There are times when in our lives we have, you know, maybe it's brief, maybe it's, you know, not just a moment, but an extended time where God feels closer, more real, more tangible, more present. You know, maybe communicates with us, speaks to us in a different way where we're more open to what his word's saying, where the Spirit of God is working in us in a different kind of way compared to kind of the regular everyday stuff. Maybe you've had that experience. It's hard, sometimes they're hard to predict. Maybe it's with a group of people or maybe you've been by yourself, but maybe you've had that kind of time. And this is the thing that we're looking at actually in both these readings today in Deuteronomy and in Luke, where there's a mountaintop, literally, experience, but in both cases, for Moses and for the disciples, there's a glimpse of glory. There's a glimpse of glory for Moses. Moses had had mountaintop experiences before. The call that Moses got. Moses, you know, grew up in Egypt, and he was in Pharaoh's house. And then had to flee Egypt because he actually killed an Egyptian who was mistreating a Hebrew slave. Moses knew that was his people, and so he defended or avenged that, and then realized that was a mistake, that's not a good move, and then fled. So then for 40 years he was in the wilderness, and he was tending sheep, and he was on a mountain, and the mountain's called Horeb. When God called to him, this is in Exodus chapter 3, and God called to him, that's the burning bush experience that Moses had. And can you imagine God speaking to you? So talk about tangible, right? Right in there, in the, you know, the bush is burning but not consumed, and the voice of God, and take off your sandals, it's holy ground, and all of that. So this is Moses' like original mountaintop experience. And the call of God is on his life, and, you know, go to Egypt, do these things, bring the people up out of the land of Egypt. And so God calls Moses to go do those things, and Moses went and did those things. A little reluctantly, but he did. And he accomplished the things that God called him to do. The people come out of Egypt, and they go to, in about Exodus chapter 20, they reach Sinai, the mountain of the Lord, which a lot of scholars actually identify because of how they're described as the same place where the call happened in Exodus 3. And that's where Moses got to go up on the mountain, and the presence of God was there, and it was the lightning and the thunder and the cloud and the whole experience, and the law, the tablets of the law were given to Moses. And he was, you know, face to face with God in that time, and he's up there on the mountain. And so he'd had a couple of these, you know, dramatic face-to-face encounters with God before. And here in this account in Deuteronomy chapter 34, he's on a mountain again, this time on Pisgah opposite Jericho, and he gets to look into the promised land. He got a view of the promised land across the way. And in verse 4, the Lord said to Moses, "This is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to your offspring." Look at the land. Here it is. This is where you're going. This is where the people are going. I've given it to your offspring. I promised it, and here it is. You're on the threshold of it. Goes on, though, "I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there." Oh. When we heard that reading, Paula leaned over to me and said, "That's always bothered me." And I agree. Like, isn't that sad? I mean, here's the guy that had the call and went and did those things, and, you know, goes on to talk about the things that Moses did that were different. You know, no one's ever done this kind of stuff before, and yet he didn't get to go to the land. It's because he was disobedient, because God had given him a command to speak to the rock, the water would flow. The people were in the wilderness, there wasn't water, they were all grumbling, right? And God said, "Prophesy to the rock, speak to the rock, water will come from the rock, and people can drink." And Moses struck the rock with the staff. Oh, didn't follow the instructions of God. And therefore didn't get to enter the land, so he got to see it, but didn't get to enter. And in fact, there were only two adult men who got to enter the land who had come up out of Egypt. Joshua and Caleb. That was it. They were two of the 12 spies that in the middle of the book of Numbers had gone into the land to spy it out, to see what was going on. And they came back, the 12 spies came back, and they were like, "Wow, it's unbelievable. You can't wait to get to this land. It's going to be incredible." But 10 of the spies were like, "However, there are some big people there and big cities and cities with walls, and we're not sure, and they're going to squash us like bugs." That's about Numbers 14, I think, if you want to review that story. And because of the report of the 10 spies, not Joshua and Caleb, but the rest of the spies, people were like, "Ooh, maybe we should do something else besides go there." Even though God was on their side, they had experienced, they'd seen tangible experience of God, not on a mountaintop, but along the way. And yet, they said, "Well, I don't know." They didn't quite trust God. So there were two adult men, Joshua and Caleb, that got to go. The generation inheriting the land were children at the time of coming up out of Egypt. It's 40 years have gone by, wandering in the wilderness. Everyone has died except those two guys. Now it's time they can enter the land. And Moses gets to see it, but doesn't get to enter. Right? He could look at what they were set to receive. God's promise to Abraham was being fulfilled. After 400 years in captivity, in slavery in Egypt, and 40 years wandering the wilderness, God was keeping his promise. Now, fast forward to Transfiguration in Luke chapter 9. There's the disciples also on a mountaintop, and they saw Jesus' glory. Verse 32 from Luke chapter 9. Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. Have you ever had a time when you're asleep, like sound asleep, and all of a sudden you're awake? Like pop, like your eyes open, you don't feel groggy, you're not like waking up like, "Oh, I need coffee," right? But all of a sudden there's like, "I'm awake, I can go do something." I remember when our kids were small, it seems like it happened with each of them. You know, when they were little, they'd be in the crib, they'd start to make a noise, and I'd wake up. Like, "I'm awake, I can go, you know, do whatever the kid, you know, one of our kids needs, whichever one it was, and, you know, roll them over, feed them, change a diaper, bring them to Paula to change a diaper, or feed them." And I remember that being like all of a sudden awake from sleep. And that's not how I usually wake up. Like, I don't wake up in the morning. Maybe you do. I don't know. But I don't wake up in the morning like, "Here we go." And I jump up out of bed, right? But when there was this, you know, that sound, or, you know, there's been a couple other times that that's happened. Usually it's when there's something different that's going to happen. Like, hey, it's the day I get to go fishing, or whatever. Like, jump up out of bed and let's go. There's something fun today. For the disciples, they were heavy with sleep, it says, and when they became fully awake. I think that's more than just we're sleeping to eyes open. I think it's more like fully aware and comprehending what's happening to them and around them and right there in front of them. They saw Jesus and it jolted them out of this grogginess, and they got a peek of the glory of God in the person of Jesus. For us, we recognize the splendor of his majesty. In Jesus, we see with eyes of faith, comprehending who Jesus is. Limited, though, because our capacity can't comprehend him. It takes faith to see who Jesus is, but he reveals himself to us, not with the mountaintop glory, you know, transfiguration kind of experience, but through his word, by the power of the Spirit working in us, we see. We see how he's revealed to us in what the word says and what witnesses have said for generations and generations. People saying this is who Jesus is has changed in us, our hearts, our spirits, to believe that Jesus is who he says, that he's the Son of God. And so we've seen him in his word. We've heard him. We've experienced him in some ways. And sometimes it's tangible, right? God at work in your life. And sometimes it's that mountaintop, wow, right? Kind of, here it is. And other times, we just have to trust and believe through faith what we know to be true because God has said it. And we experience God in a mysterious way when we receive him in the Lord's Supper. It's a tangible way, and yet mysterious, kind of hidden from what we would normally experience and understand going on in that. And yet with eyes of faith, we get this glimpse of his glory. We see Jesus. And in that time of transfiguration and on the mountain as Moses is looking in the land, simultaneously, well, not, I mean, it's different times, but in both readings, there's something going on. The Exodus is completed. For Israel, they reached the end of their journey, and that began with Moses returning to Egypt. And it started with that, and now they're coming up, and all of the experience that they'd had, the plagues and Passover, the departure from Egypt, the Egyptian army pursuing them, the sea parting, all the things that they had seen and experienced along the way, the manna and quail, the spies and the stories, the wilderness wandering, the water from the rock a couple of times, right? And they're right there. The finish line is in sight. When you're reaching the finish line, this can happen, you know, in an athletic kind of sense, if you're running or in some kind of competition. When the finish line is there, it can give you this renewal, this second wind. That can happen, though, if we have like a project. If you have your project deadline and you're up against that deadline and you're working really hard and like all of a sudden things start coming together and you can see like, oh, it's actually going to work. And it can give you this sense of renewal and energy and excitement even to finally finish. So here are the people of Israel. They've come up and they've reached the threshold. The finish line is there. They're about to get to the land. Moses gets to see it. This is the final piece that has to happen in this whole Exodus encounter. The transfiguration, Jesus' departure was looming. Verses 30 and 31 from Luke 9. Behold, two men were talking to him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now, the word departure there, right, that sounds like, you know, departing flights. When you go to the airport, right, departures. So you go that way for departures and arrivals is the different level in the airport usually, right? Departures in this text comes from the Greek word Exodus. Sound familiar? It should. Yeah. It's where we get our word Exodus from. Where we get our word exit comes from this same word. So it's in there, in the text, in the Greek language. So Jesus' exodus that is coming. So it's more than his departure. It's more than, you know, he's leaving, okay? Jesus was preparing to leave, but also he was completing his mission. He was doing and finishing what had happened with Israel there from Exodus all the way through Deuteronomy. This was the same thing was going on. He was rescuing and redeeming God's people from bondage, from slavery. In the Old Testament account, it describes in many places the mighty hand and outstretched arm of God reaching down and rescuing his people. And here was the mighty hand and outstretched arms of Jesus rescuing and redeeming his people. This is what was about to take place, what he was going to accomplish. It wasn't just that he was departing. It was much more than that. His departure took him through the cross. Wednesday, as we begin the Lent season, our focus during the midweek services is going to be the way of the cross. And we're going to look at things that happen with Jesus from right after the triumphal entry through the whole week that he experiences. What did he teach? What did he do? What things were the disciples and Jesus, what were they up to? What did that look like? As he went from the triumphal entry and everybody's like, yay, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord to crucify him. What all happened in that time? We're going to look at those this Lent season over the 6 weeks of Wednesdays, plus with Maundy Thursday and Good Friday, and we'll culminate that with Easter and the celebration of his resurrection. So his departure, his exodus, accomplished for us our redemption. The first exodus rescued God's people in a certain time and place, and the exodus of Jesus rescued people for all time and throughout the history of the world. He rescued you and me from our bondage and brought us into a place of promise. There they were in the place of promise. Moses looked beyond the land. I think Moses could see beyond the promised land, and probably he was disappointed that he didn't get to go live there, right? He was 120 years old, though, so maybe he was like, okay. But Moses is, you know, well, this is how he's remembered in verses 10 through 12. There has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. None like him for all the signs and the wonders that the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land. For all the mighty power and all the great deeds of terror that Moses did in the sight of all Israel. Moses is remembered well. He's in the two-person Hall of Fame that gets to show up on the mountain in Luke chapter 9, right? It's Moses and Elijah. And I think Moses could see this isn't just about the land that God's people were promised so long ago, and now finally, after all this time and all this experience and all this wandering, we're going to cross the river, we're going to go in, we're going to take over the land. But I think Moses could see past that. And Moses could see that this was about God keeping his promises, even though it seemed like it took a long time. And I'm sure that it did. Even though, you know, Moses wasn't going to get to enter himself, but here were the entire nation of Israel, and they were going to go. And so I think Moses could see past the land to the fulfillment of promise, that God can be trusted. That in that same land, more things were going to take place, including the fulfillment of the ultimate promise of God, that the Savior would come and that he would restore all things. So I think Moses was looking past the land, past this momentary glimpse of glory in trust, knowing that the glory of God would be revealed in a more significant way. And it was momentarily revealed in that significant way at the Transfiguration when Peter says, it's good to be here. It's good to be here. This is what he says. Peter said to Jesus, Master, it's good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah, not knowing what he said. I like those last words there. This is Peter, right? Not knowing what he said. He thought it came out his mouth. This is, I think, how Peter works, right? A random thought comes into his head, and there's not a filter, maybe. I don't know. But he seemed to be the outspoken one, the one that was ready to jump in and do things, the one that you know, was just right there, you know, even rebuking Jesus at some point. Really? Bold move, Peter. On the other hand, how did he know it was Moses and Elijah? Is that what he didn't know, that he didn't know what he was saying? I mean, did they show up with name tags on? Or was Moses still carrying around a couple of tablets? Like, oh, yeah, this is my calling card, right? This is what I look like. Elijah, he was in a chariot of fire. I don't know. I don't know how it worked. I don't know how they, you know, knew who they were. Maybe they had trading cards as kids. I don't know, right? So what did he not know? I think mostly it's he doesn't recognize what he's really suggesting. He doesn't fully comprehend that this is just for a moment. This is this momentary experience, and this is not meant to last. Now and here, there's more to come. There's more to be done. They're talking about the Exodus. They're preparing Jesus. You know, maybe it's the pep talk from two people who walked with God and were close to him. And we're like, you can do this, right? But Peter wants to make three tents. That's what the picture is that you're looking at. You know, three tents on the hillside. And let's stay. Isn't that our desire a lot of times? When we've had that kind of experience where God feels tangible and, you know, we want to stay in that moment. We want to have that linger. Sometimes it's just so brief. That tangible experience relative to a lot of the parts of our lives where God doesn't feel tangible. He doesn't even feel close, right? When we get in that grind and we get in that day-to-day and life is hard or we're just, you know, we're working a lot or we're busy or, you know, obligations and distractions and things happening and, you know, and when we have that interruption in that where God feels like he's right there, don't we want to just stay? Don't you want to just stay in the presence of God when you think, ah, that was the place to be. But right away, after Peter says that, the voice comes. First the cloud, and then Jesus is alone, and the voice comes out of the cloud saying, this is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him. You're not going to stay here. You're not going to build shelters or tents on the mountain. You're going back to the valley. When you go back, listen to him. The valley's going to seem dark and dismal and frustrating and hard. Listen to him. The valley's going to feel like, boy, nothing ever changes, and I sure miss that time on the mountain. Listen to him. The valley's going to mean hardship. And Jesus is going to experience things you don't know anything about. Listen to him. And people are going to say things that are hurtful and do things that you wish they wouldn't. Listen to him. Listen to him in the middle of life when it feels like God is distant. He's not. Listen to him. And look ahead to his promise. He goes with us into the valley where we live too. That's San Jose, by the way, down in the valley. From up on, I think, Sierra Road. He's with you in your valley. He's with you in your life. He's with you in the day-to-day when we can't see that glimpse of his glory. He's with us, and we can listen to him. Because we've seen him. Because he's revealed himself to us. We can go to the valley with that knowledge, with that hope, with that expectation, with that experience, with the expectation that Jesus will be with us every day. Maybe not in that, wow, it's good to be here kind of experience and tangible and we want to cling to it. But in the everyday, in the regular, he's still with you. He's still walking with you, and we can still follow him along the way. He's our glorified king. His exodus is for our redemption, so we can live in this valley knowing our Savior. Amen.